Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha. Always streaming on the Civic Media app.
An Ohio jury has ordered a woman to pay damages to a football player that she had accused of rape.
Cleveland.com reports a civil jury has found a woman liable for malicious prosecution in a rape allegation she made against former Ohio State football standout Garyon Conley more than 5 years ago. The accusation against Conley came shortly before the 2017 NFL draft, in which he had been projected to be a high first-round pick. The 23-year-old woman alleged that he had sexually assaulted her in a Cleveland hotel room. Conley's attorney said the sex was consensual. He asked for just $300 in damages. The jury agreed. I'm Norman Hall.
Former Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is set to return to office. Some wonder if he'll use the opportunity to push legislation to erase some of his legal troubles. Netanyahu is on trial for corruption. I'm Jackie Quinn, AP News.
Everybody.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Home heating bills in Wisconsin are going up this winter. Experts say there are steps you can take to reduce the impact. Mike Moen has more.
The Energy Information Administration predicts that Midwest households that rely on natural gas will spend an average of $1,000 on heating bills this winter. That's a 33% increase over last year. Whitney Hayes of the energy nonprofit Elevate agrees the region will see cost headaches in the coming months.
We're expecting gas prices to continue to go up this winter because of things like the war in Ukraine, and we're still doing a lot of recovery from COVID and shipping and supply shock and whatnot. So
she advises that small things such as making sure there's air sealing around windows and doors can produce savings on your bill. And energy experts say electric heat pumps have come down in price and are now more reliable in extremely cold weather. David Collada of the Citizens Utility Board agrees that heat pumps are a strong alternative to natural gas, but he stresses they still might be out of reach for low-income households and that policymakers need to offer more incentives to make them accessible to everyone. Meanwhile, he says maximizing these options will make a difference.
And if you take advantage of this program and then you'll seal cracks in windows and maybe install energy efficient light bulbs, all of that works together holistically.
For those worried about their heat being disconnected this winter, most Midwestern states have cold weather rules, which require utilities to offer a payment arrangement to avoid that scenario.
Budget billing programs don't save you money over the course of a year, but they smooth out your payments, so you pay less in the winter and more in the summer.
Mike Moen, Wisconsin News Connection.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell.
Hey, this is Jim Santel. I am the host of Morning Cannolis. Every single Saturday morning from 9 a.m. to 11 a.m., we talk about the major stories in law, in government, and the aspiration for justice in America. Delighted to have you join, call in, and be a part of our discussion right here on the networks of Civic Media.
Dueling Tangents with Luke and Brian.
I'm really trying hard not to go insane from the mind screw that is this situation. Yes. With I was going to say the GAB, but now it's the WEC, which was audited by the LAB, and then it's now screwed up by the GOP, and we're all SOL. Good for us. Congratulations.
Look at all those acronyms. Yeah.
Oh. We're the winners.
Tune in for Dueling Tangents every weekday at 2.
We have to really understand how critically important a time this is. Time for talk is over. The time for action is now. Because my voice has always been and will continue to be for people who don't have a voice.
Tune in to The Earl Ingram Show every Monday through Friday from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m. Only on WAUK 540 AM, 101.1 FM, The Shaw.
My mother was very familiar with her neighborhood, but one day she stopped at the stop sign and she wasn't even really sure where she was at.
When something feels different, it could be Alzheimer's. Now is the time to talk. A message from the Alzheimer's Association and the Ad Council.
What is dadication?
I think a parent's job is to protect our children, but also prepare them for the world so they become good, kind human beings.
That's dadication. Find out more at fatherhood.gov.
Dad, I picked up your pills, made your lunch, and your laundry is done.
When you care for a loved one, you take care of everything. But are you taking care of yourself? Find free care guides at aarp.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
If a natural disaster comes knocking, how prepared is your family? You can't just close the door on earthquakes, floods, or hurricanes and hope they go away. That's why it's important to make a plan now. Ready.gov/plan has the tools and tips you need to prepare your family for an emergency. So if disaster shows up at your doorstep, you'll be ready. Visit ready.gov/plan and make a plan today. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Morning Cannolis with James Santel is an independent product and has a joint sales agreement with Civic Media. Enjoy.
Welcome. Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel. You don't know me, but I'm your brother. Sampling the news desserts of the week, here is your host, Jim Santel.
Welcome to our second hour on this terrific Saturday morning, December 3rd, 2022. It is our 25th show, the conclusion of our first 6 months, hopefully many more months here on the studios of Civic Media. I'm in the Shaw, WAUK in Waukesha, 540 AM, 101 FM, with my outstanding producer, Kelvin. And we are taking throughout this hour, as we always do on Saturday mornings, your calls, your questions, your comments, at 844-967-2789. Delighted, as always, to hear from you as we talk about these major stories in our nation and occasionally around the world in law, in government, and the aspiration for justice in America. In our first hour, we talked about this very significant case coming out of the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, putting an end to the civil challenge against the continuing criminal investigation of the Mar-a-Lago documents case. Also talked about a very serious verdict, a very significant judgment now to be entered in the first of the Oath Keepers trials, alleging seditious conspiracy in connection with the January 6th riot, the assault on the Capitol. Others of those defendants coming up for trial in the weeks and months ahead, including others in the Proud Boys group, likewise going to be tried in front of judges and juries in Washington, D.C. We'll keep you updated on those matters as well. Again, sending this message that the events of January 6th were not simply the actions of 900 people, but were part of an organized attempt at sedition, which is the overthrow of our nation, attempt to undermine our government in attempting to ensure that the presidential election results are not endorsed and not presented properly to the United States Congress, an attempt that, as we know, was not successful. Nonetheless, the conspiracy to try to accomplish that, the result this past week of a verdict against some of these seditious conspiracy defendants, everybody facing felony convictions, facing felony judgments as a result of that. We're going to talk this coming hour about more cases in our federal and our other courts in America. Again, an ambitious but achievable agenda, including this criminal tax trial that's now coming to an end in a district court, a trial court in Manhattan. That's a state proceeding. As well, a grand jury proceeding having to do with January 6th and some significant appearances made by some individuals just this past week. And then also in a federal district court and also a federal appellate court in New York having to do with claims of sexual assault by the former president. Finally, in our last segments this hour, we're going to return to a common focus of our attention and our discussion, and that is United States Supreme Court. Because this coming week, two major cases, one being argued on Monday, one being argued on Wednesday, that have the potential once again to change our view of civil rights, our structures, about the way in which we understand human rights in America, and also, no less significantly, how we understand and apply the trappings, the rules, the processes of voting and elections in America. That coming up in our later segments of this hour on Morning Cannolis. Let's talk first about this state criminal tax trial now going on and almost concluding in a trial court in Manhattan. We know that the Trump Organization on trial for a number of different related events, personal expenses being paid by the corporation without reporting income, compensating some employees as if they were independent contractors, other things related to perhaps two sets of books, all of them implicating New York state law in the area of tax fraud. And the question is whether or not the jury is going to find the organization itself, the Trump Organization, guilty of these state felonies for engaging in this financial tax fraud that has been the subject of this trial for many weeks now. Just this past week, as the trial has concluded, presentations, again, principally by the government and also by the defense, suggesting and then attempting to attack that suggestion that the corporation, the organization, is indeed liable, criminally liable for the fraud scheme, this 15-year tax scheme that the government, the state of New York, has brought. Joshua Steinglass, who is the principal Manhattan DA who has been prosecuting this case, told jurors in his closing argument just this past week that this scheme basically helped Trump's company keep salaries down, to also shift some tax deductions to Trump entities like Mar-a-Lago, and also reduce payroll taxes and keep executives happy and loyal. So providing something the juries always want to know, which is, what's the reason for doing this? What is the motive? You can establish intent, which is different from motive. Here they're also explaining to you why it is they had the intent to engage in tax fraud. This Joshua Steinglass, the assistant DA prosecuting this case, said this: the entire defense strategy attacking, if you will, the government's case here is to promote the notion that Alan Weisselberg, again, Weisselberg, the CFO who testified principally in support of the government's case, the entire defense strategy, Steinglass says, is to promote the notion that Weisselberg did it for Weisselberg. Has a nice ring to it, he said to the jury in his closing argument, but it's just not grounded in reality. Went on to say that the chief financial officer, of course, is to be believed, even though he pled guilty and testified for the prosecution. Steinglass going on to tell jurors that Trump executives other than Weisselberg were also involved. The chief operating officer, a former general counsel, receiving Christmas bonuses as if they were independent contractors. All of that, all a part of this fairly compelling closing argument made by the prosecution in this case. One of the lawyers for the defense told jurors in response to that Weisselberg's intent was to benefit himself and not the company. Why is that significant? That's significant because the government needs to prove in this case that Weisselberg's actions were done to support, to encourage, to advance some interests of the company. There's got to be that connection between Weisselberg and doing it on behalf of the company that is still on trial for this. A woman named Susan Neschelis, who is one of the lawyers for the defense, for the corporation, for the company itself, said that Weisselberg was acting out of greed and was embarrassed about betraying the trust of the Trump family, she said in her closing argument, for whom it had worked, where he had worked for nearly five decades. And so alleging that Weisselberg himself has some motive to testify, that his testimony is not to be believed. Also, of course, invoking the notion that he himself has pled guilty, going to be spending some time in state prison, likely for this offense conduct. And again, Steinglass U.S. responding to all of that, highlighting Weisselberg's testimony, the fact it's corroborated, saved hundreds of thousands of dollars by covering about $7,000 in monthly rents on a luxury Manhattan apartment and other expenses, all of that a part of this sort of double books approach, back and forth by the attorneys for the government, by the attorneys for the defense. That's what happens in closing arguments. Now going to the trial jury to determine whether or not the corporation, the organization itself, which is the remaining defendant in this case, is in fact guilty of the offense conduct, this 15-year tax fraud scheme, anticipating likely a verdict from that jury, probably sometime in the days ahead. We can't say for sure. But plainly going to be a significant event if, in fact, the corporation, the company itself, found guilty of a felony in state court, plainly, undeniably impacting its ability to move forward. Understand, too, that this particular prosecution, a criminal prosecution by the DA, a fellow named Alvin Bragg in Manhattan, is different from, discreet from, but plainly somewhat related to the civil litigation being brought by the New York Attorney General named Letitia James. She is seeking about $250 million in a civil lawsuit against Donald Trump himself, the three Trump children, and his company for overstating asset values on properties and other residential ownership pieces in New York City. All those based upon what she maintains are fraudulent bank loans, insurance coverage, premised upon his inaccurate and deceptive valuations of those properties. This criminal prosecution, separate from that civil case, which is also going ahead among the former president's many, many concerns, legal concerns out there these days. And then in that connection as well, returning once again to January 6th, something we don't know a whole lot about in terms of substance, but significant in the rule of law because it happened this past week. We know that there is at least one federal grand jury, apart from the January 6th committee itself, a federal grand jury in the district court in Washington, D.C., that is investigating what happened with January 6th. Beyond the 900 people already being prosecuted for their on-the-ground offenses, beyond the seditious conspiracy charges against the Proud Boys, against others out there, the Oath Keepers, those trials coming up soon. We know that there's a federal grand jury that's also looking at people at the top. Who is in charge of this? Who is sending messages to others, including some of these other defendants, that resulted in the January 6th insurrection, the riot on the Capitol? That grand jury looking at all of this, including presumably things like the false electors case as well, coming out of Wisconsin and other states around the country. Why is this significant? What happened just this past week? Well, we know that just this past week, there were two important appearances by Pat Cipollone, the former White House counsel, and his deputy, Pat Philbin. They were appearing just this past week in front of a federal grand jury investigating all of this. Now, the reason this is significant is that, of course, Pat Cipollone, you recall, will have testified before the January 6th committee, the House committee, but declined to talk about specific conversations that he had with the former president based upon attorney-client privilege and perhaps other privileges as well. This was a subject now of some discourse, some disagreement, some argument before a federal district court judge. Her name is Beryl Howell. She is the chief judge in the District of Columbia. And just previous to their appearances before the grand jury, the judge resolved those privilege matters and said, no, you've got to appear in front of the grand jury. You've got to talk about what the president and presumably others said to you in connection with January 6th. We don't know, and we may know at some point down the road, but grand jury transcripts not produced immediately. We'll see down the road what comes of that, but the testimony itself in front of this grand jury just this past week, another major milestone in justice in America. Stay with us as we talk about yet more events in the courts of our nation here on Morning Cannolis.
You are listening to your local Civic Media radio station on air. Thank you. Did you know we are always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app too? And if you miss a show or game, find it wherever you get your podcasts or on our website, civicmedia.us.
We have a full hour with Milwaukee County Executive David Crowley.
Yes, thank you for having me. So glad to be in studio.
Listen Monday through Friday from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. for As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry.
You know, whether you're a Democrat or Republican, whether you are a union member or a business owner, picking up your garbage has no partisan lines. Making sure people can get to and from work shouldn't have partisan lines.
Listen to As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry right here on The Shaw.
I'm Chris Jakimic. I served in the United States Air Force, and I deployed 3 times. So in 2017, I was serving as an Air Force First Sergeant. Our motto in that role is, my job is people, everyone is my business. But unfortunately, in that year, I would lose my own brother, Lance Corporal Adam Jakimic, to suicide. The majority of veteran suicides are from guns. I store my weapons securely, not only for myself, but for my family. Store all your guns securely. Help stop suicide. My service never stops.
Brought to you by End Family Fire and the Ad Council.
It's 4 a.m. and you're sucking baby snot through a tube because she's congested. If you love her that much, love her enough to make sure she's buckled in the right car seat. Find out more at nhtsa.gov/the right seat. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Here's your updated forecast on the Shaw. Bright sunshine this afternoon with highs around 26. Winds out of the west, 10 to 20 miles an hour. Clear skies again tonight. Lows level off around 17. Bright sunshine expected tomorrow. Highs around 36. Mixed precipitation possible at times Monday with highs in the upper 30s. More clouds than sun Tuesday. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Derek Height. Currently, it's 21 degrees.
WAUK 540 AM. New Berlin's choice for news talk radio. Streaming 24/7 at waukradio.com.
Thank you for continuing to engage with me in our discussion, our review, our travels through major events in the rule of law this past week, including just before the break in our first segment in this second hour, a review of the Trump criminal tax trial in the Manhattan District Court, that coming to a conclusion fairly soon, perhaps anticipating a verdict in the coming weeks of the coming days of the coming business week. And also an appearance by Pat Cipollone and Patrick Silbin, the former White House counsel and his deputy, before one of the grand juries investigating the January 6th events and other matters related to that. Significant just because their appearances up to now, have presumably been somewhat restricted by their invocation of privilege, something that the district court effectively resolved, permitting that testimony to go ahead this past week. We will find out, presumably at some point down the road, what the results of that testimony has been. Also this past week, in yet another grand jury, this one investigating the Mar-a-Lago matter, getting back to those very first issues coming out of Mar-a-Lago and South Florida. Another grand jury hearing testimony from the former media director Dan Scavino and the former deputy director of presidential advance, a fellow named William Russell, and Bo Harrison. All of those people appearing before a federal grand jury investigating the handling of classified documents found at the Mar-a-Lago estate. So those testimonial appearances also happening in Washington, D.C., even as we said at the top of our 2 hours this program, this morning in our program, the 11th Circuit clearing the way for that investigation to go forward full speed, perhaps involving at some point down the road a return by a grand jury of individuals responsible for that. Lots and lots of things going on in federal grand juries in the United States District Court for the District of Columbia. We'll watch all of those for you. And then moving back to New York and a combination of both state and federal courts. Let's talk again about E. Jean Carroll. We have chatted about her on this broadcast in the past. You may recall well that she brought a initially state court action against the former president while he was still the president for defamation. She had alleged in some publications that he had assaulted her in a department store in New York way back in the 1990s. The president, while he was the president, had allegedly defamed her by saying that she's a liar, said other things about her, and she brought a lawsuit initially in the trial courts in New York, ultimately removed by the United States Department of Justice into federal court on the basis that Donald Trump was acting in the scope of his federal employment in saying those things about E. Jean Carroll. Well, this past week, that issue, whether or not the removal of that case from state court to federal court and effectively the substitution of the United States of America for Donald Trump was proper, that before the D.C. Court of Appeals, the Washington Court of Appeals, determining whether or not a president saying these kinds of things while he, or perhaps one day she, is in office, whether those kinds of things are in the scope of their employment such that this case is properly removed, this United States substituted, and the reason why that is significant is that you can't pursue, can't obtain a judgment against the federal government for defamation. Those arguments made just this past Thursday in front of the United States Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. Very significant in terms of what the future may hold for that case, but also for this notion of what a president does and does not do in the scope of his or her personal and official capacities. This is what the attorneys for E. Jean Carroll said to the Court of Appeals, said that Trump and the Department of Justice, for their part, have responded to these developments by asking this court to announce a categorical rule that elected officials always and automatically act within their employment whenever they address the public. The attorneys for E. Jean Carroll went on to say this: this court should reject that position and hold that the former president acted outside the scope of his employment when he repeatedly defamed E. Jean Carroll in June of 2019. Went on to say this: Trump's defamatory statements targeting Carroll after she revealed that he had raped her were outside of his employment as president. He acted with private motives, E. Jean Carroll's attorneys say, not in furtherance of any official federal purpose or function in seeking to punish and humiliate Carroll for revealing his decades-old crime. So that matter now before the Court of Appeals of the Second Circuit, they'll determine whether or not this case is properly in federal court or should go back to state court. Significantly, as you well know, as we reported on this broadcast in the past, E. Jean Carroll has also brought a second case under New York state law, that under the New York Adult Survivors Act. She claims defamation, same predicate, but different kind of statement by the president recently under his new social media platform, again alleging that this never happened, alleging that she is lying. And also she alleges battery under this new law in New York that allows an adult assault victim to file claims that would otherwise be barred by the passage of time. So that new lawsuit filed, again pending in state court, the parallel to this federal case now before the Court of Appeals. And to make this even more complicated, that federal case still going ahead in the district court. We know that the former president was deposed at least once in that matter, permitted by the trial court judge. All of this happening in New York, variously in and out of federal and state courts, premised upon these allegations of assault way back in the 1990s, and again, alleged defamation by the president recently, very recently, and again while he was president. Lots to take in there, lots to look at, lots to monitor as we go down the road. Let's begin to take some additional callers here. Dick, thanks for calling in from Madison. Thanks for being a part of our program this morning.
A little off topic, but you were talking about the situation with the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys earlier, and I read something about a week ago about something I didn't even know about that happened in 2018.
And Dick, you know what I'm going to have you do? I'm going to have you keep that thought because I'm going to do a small break here. I want you to stay with me, okay, if you will, and I'll take your question right after this break, and we'll talk more about those Oath Keepers and other things that you saw recently. Stay with me, Dick.
WAUK 540 AM, Brookfield's choice for news talk radio. Streaming 24/7 at waukradio.com.
It's easy to listen to your favorite local radio station anytime. Download the Civic Media app from the Apple or Google Play Store, then listen live or whenever you want from anywhere for free.
This local musical interlude is brought to you by Max Inc. Radio. Kelsey Miles. Listen to Max Inc. Radio every Saturday and Sunday, 6 p.m. to midnight. Download the podcast at maxincradio.com. We are local music.
I grew up hearing that women are bad with money, but I pay bills and take care of my family, so I'm pretty good with money. And now I'm taking control of my financial future by saving for retirement. Jumpstart your retirement savings at wesaysaveit.org. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
AP News, I'm Ben Thomas. More details on Tuesday night's mass shooting that killed six in Chesapeake, Virginia. Our Mike Kempen has them.
Investigators say the Walmart supervisor who shot and killed six co-workers left behind what he called a death note. Andre Bing blamed others for mocking him and said he wishes his parents would have paid closer attention to his social deficits. Bing also said he did not plan the shooting, but that, quote, "things just fell in place like I was led by the Satan," unquote. Co-workers who survived the shooting say he was known for being difficult and for being hostile with employees. Police say Bing legally purchased the 9mm gun he used the day of the killings. He had no criminal record. Bing died at the scene of an apparent self-inflicted gunshot wound. I'm Mike Hempen.
Residents of Colorado Springs are reassessing things after last weekend's mass shooting at a gay nightclub. State Representative Leslie Harrod says she'd hoped the city would have aged out of hate.
Of transphobia, of racism, of, you know, of homophobia. We're not going to just age out of it.
In fact, she says some are breeding it. Her answer?
We have to actively teach a new narrative. We have to actively embrace people who are different than us or those who are just like us and see us for who we are completely. Colorado Springs should lead that now.
In his nightly address, Ukraine's President Vladimir Zelensky says the number of people without power across the country has been halved, but that leaves 6 million still experiencing blackouts, the result of Russian strikes. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg says the alliance's commitment to Ukraine is unwavering.
Allies are providing unprecedented military support, and I expect foreign ministers will also agree to step up non-lethal support.
COVID-19 numbers are trending upward in the U.S. The CDC's tracker shows cases and deaths on the rise. This is AP News.
So all you folks out there, if you haven't registered to vote, register to vote. Get ready to vote. There are so many things on the ballot this November, at our freedom, our liberty, and our way of life. But we'll get to all of that this evening.
The Paul Revere Show with Mark Thompson. Listen Monday, 7 to 8 p.m. on the Shaw 101 FM and WAUK 540 AM.
Dueling Tangents with Luke and Brian.
I'm really trying hard not to go insane from the mind screw that is this situation. Yes. With I was going to say the GAB, but now it's the WEC, which is audited by the LAB, and then it's now screwed up by the GOP, and we're all SOL. Good for us. Congratulations.
Look at all those acronyms. Yeah.
We're the winners.
We are back here on Morning Cannolis. We're chatting with one of our good callers. Dick from Madison has called in. Dick, right before the break, we were beginning to chat with you about something that you read in connection with the Oath Keepers, Proud Boys, and wanted to resume our discussion with you. Your comment or question right before the break. Go right ahead, Dick.
Well, it dates back as far as 2018, and then they had intervened in a situation with a club I'd never heard of, the Metropolitan Republican Club, that was founded way back in 1902, and they were supporters of Theodore Roosevelt. But these two guys were actually convicted and sent to prison for 4 years that long ago. I guess my question is, they point out in the article that the party slash the country has survived other extremist right-wing groups like, you know, the Birch Society back in the 60s. But this group seems to be, both of them, just a little bit wilder, crazier, and, for lack of better words, resilient.
Right.
What is it going to take, James, to shut these people down?
Right, right. And I think your concern, Dick, is one that many people, all people of all parties share, regardless of your political persuasion, because, again, the evidence in this trial just now concluded show that they were ready with weapons across the river. They were ready to come in upon direction, instruction from someone, maybe the former president, maybe other people. This was going to be an armed assault on the Capitol, but even more than that, these were folks who were quite literally, as the charge alleges, trying to overthrow the government. What will it take? It's more than a rhetorical question, right? To send that message that not only are these people, should they be stopped, but others who might do the same kind of thing. This is not America, and the message has got to be out there that if you engage in this kind of behavior, you will be on the receiving end of an indictment. We are hopeful that these additional prosecutions coming up of Proud Boys, of the Oath Keepers coming up in the next few weeks and few months, send the same messages. The juries looking at this will say this was not simply people misguided on January 5th or 6th. These are people who intended to undermine and overthrow our government to stop this. And again, the evidence quite compelling, not only in support of conspiracy, but their overt acts undertaken in an attempt to try to accomplish just that. Very, very important comment. Appreciate that call very, very much. And also appreciate Matt calling in this morning from Madison. Appreciate your being a part of our program this morning. Matt, your comment or question as well.
Hi, Jim. It goes back to the Mar-a-Lago documents.
Yes.
It's actually has to do with the social media, too.
Yes.
What do you make, or what is the usefulness of Trump effectively admitting, I think it was on Truth, where he said, I took the documents, right?
Like, right.
I'm hoping that in the course of this trial, we can jump past the did he do it or not,
right,
and move right on to their, in my opinion, inane argument that he was allowed to.
Right.
Is that accurate? I'll take my answer off the air.
Absolutely. Great, great observation. Again, not only in the media, but reported from the president's own pen, his own social media platform, I took the documents. That is also out there. People often think that just because it's on social media, well, geez, somehow it's off. It's not appropriate to present that during the course of a trial. Just the opposite. Social media, you make statements on social media, whether it's on Twitter, it's on Truth Social, whatever your platform is, can in fact be used. I often say on this broadcast and others that when the president sat down with Lester Holt many, many years, months ago now, and said that, yes, I fired Jim Comey because of that Russia thing, he's admitting to obstruction of justice. And just because he does it in a news format, in a public format, doesn't mean it cannot be used. And you're absolutely right, Matt. That's the kind of thing that if I were Jack Smith, I am not, but he is very, very good. He knows this well. Anticipate that kind of thing will be presented if indeed the president and others are indicted for the Mar-a-Lago events. That is clearly a statement, not only contrary to his interest, but it implicates him in doing that. He understood what he was doing. He took them. Now, there's more to the case, obviously, but that provides a significant, important predicate for going ahead. You got to believe that Jack Smith took note of that. It's a part of the government's file now as a grand jury looks at this, as Jack Smith and all the staff looking at Mar-a-Lago continues that investigation. A great point made. Very much appreciate. Thank you for that observation as well, Matt. Let's, in our remaining moments and time together this morning, turn to another building also on Capitol Hill, and that is the United States Supreme Court. We have spent a lot of time in previous broadcasts talking about some of the major cases, 10, 12 cases pending in front of our high court in this term, the 2022-2023 term, and those include, plainly, a number that are going to affect the ways in which we live, our lives, our livelihood in America. Just this past week, the United States Supreme Court said that it will add to its docket, just right now, in excess of about 40 cases altogether, add to its docket this issue related to whether or not President Biden's decision to implement this cancellation of student loan debt initiative, affecting quite literally millions of people in America, challenged in lower courts and overturned, overruled, vacated, basically on the basis that the courts found that this was an inappropriate exercise of executive authority, whether or not those lower court rulings stopping that initiative from going forward, stopping the Department of Education from reviewing applications, from taking applications on this student loan cancellation program, whether that is appropriate or not. The Supreme Court, just this past week, upon the petition of the president through the Department of Justice, has agreed to review the legality of that cancellation program involving millions of borrowers, as you well know. The cases brought, the case coming out of the Eighth Circuit in particular, brought by a group of six states, Iowa, Arkansas, Kansas, Missouri, Nebraska, South Carolina, all challenging that plan. Oral arguments set now before the United States Supreme Court for February, a decision likewise, as is it will be in these other cases, anticipated probably by May or June. And again, the difficulty in all of that, of course, is it stops this process from going ahead. The fact the Supreme Court's going to take it on is significant, but we'll have to wait now, 5 or 6 months before that initiative can be either determined to be constitutional, in which case it goes ahead, or if the Supreme Court says something else and determines that the lower courts are accurate in finding that the program needs to be stopped. Two other things coming up just this week, and I want to spend our remaining moments here this morning on Morning Cannolis talking about the future, the days just ahead. Two major cases that we have talked about on this broadcast in previous Saturday mornings, one of them having to do with civil rights and human rights, the other having to do with voting in America, elections. Who decides elections? Who decides the results, processes, and procedures as well? On Monday, December 5th, the United States Supreme Court is going to be hearing oral argument in a case called 303 Creative versus Elenis, E-L-E-N-I-S. And again, we have talked about this case in prior broadcasts. We know from the past broadcasts, but more importantly, from documents filed in the United States Supreme Court. And we'll hear again about this in the argument before the United States Supreme Court this coming Monday morning, that the principal petitioner here, a woman named Smith, who is the provider of wedding support services. She provides wedding websites out of Colorado for clients, providing information about ceremony details and pictures, stories about the couple, often including a biblical quote celebrating marriage through that process that individuals become one flesh, according to her website. She has not, however, agreed to serve same-sex couples and provide that website service to anyone who is a same-sex couple in the course of their wedding preparation. Now, there's a Colorado civil rights law that prohibits discrimination based upon many immutable characteristics, including, yes, indeed, sexual orientation. And it is that state statute that the government of Colorado has said that Ms. Smith has violated by failing to provide services to same-sex couples and also posting boldly on her website that she refuses to do so. And that's significant because what the Supreme Court's going to be deciding in this case, focusing in particular upon free speech and this First Amendment notion. The stakes are very high in this case, as you can well imagine. Basically, pitting, if you will, the right of LGBT, QIA members of that community to seek goods and services from businesses without discrimination. Against, if you will, the right to free speech under the U.S. Constitution, the First Amendment. Smith herself says this. She says, Colorado is compelling and censoring my free speech, forcing me to design and create custom artwork that celebrates messages that go against my deeply held beliefs. My faith is at the core of who I am. That is her position as she goes forward and argues this. Now, as I indicated, the Supreme Court has limited its review of a lower court decision coming out of the appeals court that is found in favor of Colorado, has said, yes, indeed, the Colorado law should, in fact, be forced in this way, and Ms. Smith cannot do this in violation of that state statute. So she is appealing this. She is maintaining that not only does she have the right under the First Amendment to pursue her business as she wants to, but that the law itself should not prevent her from doing that. And the Supreme Court, while this case is involving plainly both faith and religious beliefs, as she has described it, and also First Amendment rights, has limited it pretty much to the First Amendment focus. Now, as a practical matter, on Monday, highly likely, that the United States Supreme Court is going to be addressing all of these things. It's hard to separate out all of those First Amendment concepts, as we know. First Amendment providing freedom of religion, both in terms of establishment and exercise of it, and also free speech. And so all of that coming up this coming Monday before the United States Supreme Court. The court also plainly working in the wake of its previous case that many of you will recall well, previously. When the Supreme Court, in a legal battle way back in 2018, addressed whether or not that same Colorado anti-discrimination law applied to a fellow named Jack Phillips. You may recall he was this bakery owner in the Denver area who refused to provide services to same-sex couples. He was making cakes, not websites, but cakes. And in the end, the Supreme Court heard oral argument on that issue, decided not to resolve the issue of whether or not the First Amendment rights are greater, the First Amendment rights to religion and to free speech are greater than the rights of individuals, including those of the LGBT community, to engage in commercial enterprise, to do that in a non-discriminatory fashion that does not prohibit them from engaging in all the other things that others do in America. The Supreme Court, in the end, didn't really resolve that issue, basically sent it back to the Colorado authorities at that time, determining that Colorado officials at that time had violated the Jack Phillips' religious rights by not giving him the process, the procedural rights he'd otherwise have, carving out an exemption for him under the anti-discrimination law. So didn't really resolve the issue. It is back. It is back. Again, in this case coming up on Monday, 303 Creative versus Alanis, determining whether or not which one of these interests is the greater interest. We know from our past discussions and the past history of the United States Supreme Court that it is very common for them to take on religious cases. Interesting that here that they have carved out the religious aspect of it somewhat, but nonetheless taking on this case to determine whether or not which one of these conflicting interests, if you will, preside and which one take precedent over the other. My own view is that they both can live together, right? As the Colorado authorities are saying, we're not telling Ms. Smith not to abide by and follow her own views that she has under her own faith and her own spiritual beliefs, her religious beliefs. But what she cannot do, is engage in discriminatory conduct, behavior as to a significant portion of the population, the LGBTQIA population, in particular same-sex couples. That's their position. Seems to me that those things can be reconciled without doing violation to either one of those. And we'll see. We'll see on Monday how the Supreme Court comes down. We know that the Supreme Court has often sided in favor of religious positions in the past, and will determine down the road, presumably in May or June, which one of those seemingly competing interests holds sway when it comes to resolving this case, 303 Creative versus Alanis, coming up for oral argument this coming Monday morning on the 5th. As we come back for our final segment, another case before the Supreme Court this coming Wednesday. Stay tuned for that discussion right after this break.
The Downtown Waukesha Christmas Parade is Sunday, December 4th, and WAUK 540 AM and 101 FM is proud to cover all the festivities. Parade coverage starts at 3 p.m. The coverage is brought to you by Mia's Kitchen and Pizzeria,
delicious, fresh, home-style Italian. And Planned Parenthood. Care no matter what. Affordable health care without judgment. Book your appointment today at ppwi.org. And Albanese's Roadhouse, authentic Italian family restaurant, sports bar, and grill.
Hi, it's Don Brown, host of This Week in Waukesha, inviting you to catch our coverage of this year's 2022 Waukesha Christmas Parade, Sunday, December 4th. The coverage starts at 3, the parade starts at 4. We'll be live in front of the Walk Radio Studios talking to the marchers, the participants, the fans, and all the people that make this parade in this community a very special place. Waukesha Christmas Parade, covered here on Walk Radio 540 AM, 101 FM, The Shaw.
Suddenly, my quarterback is the number one trending topic. Why, you might ask, is Aaron Rodgers trending on Twitter? He's out this game. He's got COVID-19. And to my perception, he freaking lied to us, man. I'm very frustrated that he is not eligible to play this Sunday, especially when you find out your quarterback is a half a Trumpster. And he claims, I'm not a flat earther, I'm not an anti-vaxxer. I just play one in the NFL. That pisses me off, man. I was going to bet on that team. Maybe. New time, 3 to 6 p.m. And Dom!
Here's your updated forecast on the Shaw. Bright sunshine expected this afternoon with a high of 26. Winds out of the west, 10 to 20 miles an hour. Clear skies and quiet again tonight. Lows dip down to about 17. Clear skies tomorrow, high of 36. Upper 30s Monday, with mixed precipitation possible at times. Low 30s, mainly cloudy, Tuesday. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Derek Height. Currently, it's 21 degrees.
A progressive voice from Manitowoc to Janesville. WAUK 540 AM. Always streaming at waukradio.com.
We are back for our final segment here in Morning Cannoli is our discussion of law and all things justice, the aspiration for justice in America. In our final moments here today, my discussion, my presentation to you about another case that we have talked about before, pending before the United States Supreme Court. Strong encouragement, if you have the time, if you've got the interest, and I know you all do, in hearing what our Supreme Court is thinking about these major cases, including this case coming out of Colorado that we talked about right before the break. That case is going to be argued this coming Monday morning. And then this coming Wednesday, the 7th, also at 10 o'clock Eastern Time, 9 o'clock Eastern Time, you can hear it live. You can also hear it recorded down the road from the United States Supreme Court on their website as well. Listen to the voices of the Supreme Court justices themselves as they question the attorneys for the parties in all of these cases. All of that accessible online, live, and then also recorded down the road. The second case I want to highlight for your attention. This is the matter that I've identified, and I think many other people who are also focused on the Supreme Court have identified as perhaps the most significant case of this term, arguably in recent years, not in any way diminishing the impact of a recent civil rights cases involving privacy rights and abortion and guns and environment and many other things. This case is called Moore versus Harper. Moore versus Harper, again, we've chatted about in the past. It comes out of North Carolina, as other states have done, including Wisconsin, in the past election cycle, in the past census cycle. North Carolina draws new lines for its congressional districts, also state assemblies, state senate districts. And along the way, our legislature draws lines in such a way that according to many people, disenfranchises people of color. Gets up to the North Carolina Supreme Court, and the North Carolina agrees with those folks and says, you know what, these lines that you have drawn, legislature, do in fact compromise the right of people to vote, the right of people to gain access to the polls, and so go back and do it again. The North Carolina legislature says, nope, we're not going to do that. Not only did we not violate the Voting Rights Act, not only have we not discriminated against, not disenfranchised people, but beyond that, and here is why this case is so very important. In this case, Moore versus Harper, the legislature coming out of North Carolina says the North Carolina courts have nothing to do with this. The North Carolina Supreme Court, lower courts should not be involved at all in matters related to the times, places, manners, anything having to do with
with elections in America, including in North Carolina. They use this argument premised upon what's called the Elections Clause in the Constitution. It's Article 1, Section 4, and it says the times, places, and manner of holding elections for senators and representatives shall be prescribed in each state by the legislature thereof, but the Congress may from time to time alter or make such regulations as it may feel are appropriate. They use that language, again, consistently interpreted to mean that state legislatures set the rules in states for elections. We know that. That's true in Wisconsin, every other state in America. To say that the courts have no involvement in this at all. And along the way, this doctrine called the independent state legislature doctrine is advanced, a doctrine that has been explicitly discarded by the Supreme Court on at least four previous occasions when it's addressed this, a doctrine that can only be regarded as a fringe doctrine not embraced by anyone with a sensitivity and an understanding of our Constitution, a doctrine that, as many people have observed, and I've observed as well, tends to stand elections on their head. And the key to this argument is that this exclusivity of the legislature's authority would basically be contrary to, again, 240 years of our own laws, that the courts themselves would not have the prerogative to intervene and determine whether or not processes and procedures and rules and laws for conducting elections are appropriate, that huge, but also could make decisions based upon their own views about what happened during the course of those elections, make determinations about who actually won. So kind of a twofold threat to democracy under this. State courts cannot change what the legislature has enacted. That's what this doctrine says. And it's only the legislature that can decide whether or not the courts are making a change. So that in Moore, this case pending before the Supreme Court, the question is whether North Carolina Supreme Court allegedly improperly supplanted the gerrymandered districts by that state legislature. The theory, as it's applied here in this case, effectively, as I indicated, upends our traditional notions of judicial review, where the legislature sets the rules, but the courts always, for two centuries, have served as the ultimate arbiters of statutory and constitutional interpretation. That is a significant change. And the fact that the United States Supreme Court is even taking this case on should give us all pause, regardless of one's view, regardless of your Republican, a Democrat. This goes to the very legitimacy of our elective process, our polling, our voting. The second reason why this is so very significant, not just for North Carolina, not just for the voters there and the lines that are drawn there, is because it applies plainly to all states, not just North Carolina. This independent state legislature doctrine opens up the possibility that the state legislature can overturn the decision of a duly empowered state elective office, election officials, in deciding whom to seat, not only in our federal legislature, our congressmen and women, our senators as well, but also, of course, presidential electors could substitute, if you will, the decisions of the voting population in a particular state, Wisconsin, North Carolina, could substitute their own view based upon what? Well, perhaps coming forward and saying, well, we've got some concerns about fraud, something else identified in the state legislature, substitute their decision for the decisions of the voters. A great concern, as I have said before, in this Moore versus Harper case, Supreme Court is even entertaining this, could change dramatically, not just the elections going forward in 2023 and 2024, but also for all time, could change again in the Electoral College how our electors are chosen, how the numbers are sent to Washington, D.C. Again, a real threat to our future democracy. People on all sides of the political aisle should be very concerned about this, and they are. Listen in on Wednesday morning at 10 o'clock Eastern Time, 9 o'clock Central Time, to hear the Supreme Court justices wrestle with this issue. We'll get a pretty good sense about how they're going to decide this case down the road. Moore versus Harper. We'll chat about that more down the road as well. And finally, in our closing moments here on Morning Cannolis, want to reaffirm what my good colleague and friend has told you along the way. That's Don Brown talking about his plans tomorrow afternoon, beginning at 3 o'clock, to provide not only color commentary, but encouragement to all of us when it comes to the parade here. I'm going to be around as well. The parade here in Waukesha, the Christmas parade, resuming at 4 o'clock. Be a part of that coverage, whether you're in person, whether you're a part of our broadcast tomorrow afternoon as well. For today in Waukesha, have a good day, everybody. We'll see you tomorrow and again next Saturday morning. Take care.
Catch Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow at its brand new time, 6 to 8 a.m. weekdays.
The city of Shanghai started administering an inhalable COVID-19 vaccine. I hear a lot of you saying the same thing I had in my head. I don't know about that.
As long as they're not just crop dusting everyone.
Crop dusting, that's exactly what I think people would be fearful of. I would not trust the Chinese government. I would trust people who really know about inhaling something and the good that it does you. Of course, I'm talking about Dom and Kroot.
What is dedication?
My daughter started making necklaces. She makes what we call affirmation fashion. I tell her every day that your black is beautiful. And if there's anything better than being beautiful, it's being smart. And if there's anything better than being smart, it's being kind. And reaffirming that every day is our method of making sure her chin never drops.
That's dedication. Visit fatherhood.gov to hear more. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the...
You are listening to WAUK 540 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, always streaming on the Civic Media app.